recognize us again for a wonderful 4 weeks, or almost 4 weeks. So this is not, obviously not a talk which is really in the on the subject of the gathering, but with a bit of luck it'll be intelligible to everybody. The title explains precisely what the talk is about. For me, the zeta function, or for today, the zeta function is simply this. I shan't need any analytic continuation, any kind of information about the primes, at least as far as this series is concerned. This will just be numbers given by series. And the theorem is exactly, whose proof I shall outline, is exactly the one stated in the title. So infinitely many of the numbers zeta of 3, zeta of 5, zeta of 7, and so on, are irrational, fail to belong to Q. The history of this is not terribly long. In 1978, Apéry discovered a way to prove that zeta of 3 is irrational.
You didn't prove transcendental?
Oh, no. Transcendence for these things is totally unknown. Nothing like that is known. No. And the details, or a careful proof, was given that this method worked by Coin and Saguier shortly after he described the method. And the method he used was the time-honoured one for numbers which presumably are transcendental, namely this. You construct a sequence of linear forms in the number that you are interested in, and these things converge to zero but are not equal to zero, provably not equal to zero. And the coefficients are integers. And this is sufficient to prove that zeta of 3 is irrational, because if zeta of 3 were p over q, then such an expression, if it's non-zero, is always at least 1 over q in size, so they couldn't tend to zero. Okay, the method by which these forms, or let's say were described at least, was as the convergence of a continued fraction.
Not all of them are irrational.
I'm sorry. Of course, we believe they're all transcendental, yes, naturally. But what's provable and what we believe is really quite a different matter here. So, Apéry's forms come from this continued fraction. And the general term is minus k to the sixth over 2k plus 1. 17k squared, 17k plus 5, so not necessarily the first thing you'd write down, but there are ways with hindsight of understanding why you expect a fraction of this kind at least to exist, whether you can immediately see what the coefficients are or not. Okay, now in our case, we're going to give a somewhat different approach. I should explain that this is joint work with Tanguy Rivoal. And the method we are going to use is to construct linear forms, but in more than one value of zeta. So we want forms of the following kind. Let me index them by m, just as I did those, but I'll need some other index for the terms. So these will be linear forms in the odd number values of zeta, with coefficients which will be integers. That I'll explain a little bit more how that occurs. And what will be important about these forms is that we will have some distinction between the sizes of the coefficients, the a's, and the value of the actual form. So the coefficients in size will only be of the order constant to the power m times d, where m and d are as you see, and the size of the form itself, the actual sum when you put in the zetas, will be at most e to the minus constant md, and then an extra log d. So here lambda and mu, of course, are positive constants. Well, what's important is that mu is positive, but clearly lambda is going to be as well. And where we win is this extra log d. So this is what gives us the gain here. And how does it work? So suppose suppose that at most j of the zeta values are irrational, that all the others are rational, and of course you want to show then that j is quite large. That's the aim. We take j plus one of these forms, these linear forms, and when we put in the actual values, some of the, many of them therefore will be rational, and there'll be rationals with some common denominator which we can clear. It'll be the same for every form, so clear denominators. So apart from the irrational ones, which we're, as it were, leaving as they are, we will just have integers. And we collapse all the integer parts into some coefficient at the end. So collapse the integer parts. And then we write down the coefficients of these forms in a grid, so in a matrix. So here we'll have some new coefficient, b0, b1, up to bj for my j plus 1 forms. That will be the integer column. And then here I'll have a column corresponding to zeta of s1, let's say, and then columns corresponding to zeta of sj, which are the ones which are supposed to be irrational, okay, or allowed to be irrational. And then there'll be some coefficients for these. Let me, by abuse of notation, call them sort of the same thing as I did before. Obviously, they're not quite the same A's, but you get the point. Okay, so if
A or not, does it depend on D, or does it?
Oh, yes, the coefficients will certainly depend upon D. So I'm fixing, in a sense, I'm fixing D, and I'm constructing a sequence of forms as M increases. And for different D's, I may get totally different forms, yeah.
Now, those forms will be non-zero, right?
Sorry?
They're all non-zero. Or not yet?
They will be in a second, yes. Yeah. They'll be much more than non-zero, of course. That's essential. Okay, so what can we say? Our aim, of course, is to cross-cancel all the values of zeta. So, in other words, we take the determinant. And on the one hand, it's an integer because all the entries in the matrix are integers. On the other hand, we can replace the first column by the actual value of form 0 up to form j, because we can simply add appropriate multiples of the remaining columns. So we simply add zeta s1 of this column, zeta s2 of the second the next column, and so on, to produce the actual values of the forms, and it won't change the determinant. And once you've done that, you can then see that the absolute value of the determinant cannot be more than the number of things you sum over when you write it in terms of permutations, multiplied by the number of times that you pick up the size of a coefficient from the remaining columns, and those coefficients are only constant to the MD, but we pick up J of them. And clearing the denominators, of course, doesn't essentially change the estimates on the sizes. And then in the first column, we pick up e to the minus mu md log d. And here what's going to happen, you can see, is that as m goes to infinity, this is going to force j to be bigger than log d. We have an integer, and as long as the determinant is non-zero,
so is j, or what is
j? No, j is, we said that most j are irrational.
And so it's the maximum of these irrational.
Some function of j.
Some function of, you take the maximum of sj such that sj is in.
No, I've just said suppose that most j are irrational, and I'm going to want to show that j is big. That's all.
Okay, so it's also bigger than something.
D.
Yeah, how do you choose D?
Well, okay, J will depend upon D. If I take D of them, if I've got more to work with, I'm going to find more irrational ones. Yeah, right. Okay, so we end up with we get J at least log D. So in other words, among the first D, we find at least log D, which are irrational. Okay.
You have even quantity.
Sorry?
You have even a weak kind of density of
it. Yes, exactly. It's a rather weak density, yes. Yeah. Okay, so the question is how we build these linear forms. Perhaps I'll write that here. And the starting point here, probably the best thing to do is to go back to Apéry's forms and mention that Boyker's soon afterwards found integral representations for these, and also for some other forms that Apéry constructed which were sufficient to show the irrationality of zeta of 2, although since zeta of 2 is pi squared over 6, that was, of course, already known. And for forms corresponding to zeta of 2, which is pi squared over 6. So that wasn't a new result, but it happened that the same method gave nice approximations to zeta of 2. And if you look at Boyker's forms for zeta of 2, then you can easily write those, can easily be written as a series, although for the zeta of 3 ones, it's not clear how to do it. But for the zeta of 2 ones, it's obvious. So I'll explain what the series is, and this will be the start, the starting point for constructing the forms I actually want. And that particular series is this. So on the top, I'm summing over k. On the top, I have k minus 1 down to k minus m. And on the bottom, k plus 1 up to k plus m, in this case, squared, the two being the same two in as in zeta of 2. Okay. Now, what we're going to do, well, I should perhaps just mention that extensions of these were already studied by Nikishin, in which the 2 was replaced by some larger number, and that's certainly what we're going to do. So we look at series such as the following, where P will be a polynomial with, let's say, rational coefficients. That's what's most important. And then I put power D here instead. Now, why do these series give us linear forms in the values of the zeta function? So the first thing is, why do we get linear forms? Of the kind that we want. Well, suppose we split the sumand into partial fractions, then we will get terms which have the following shape. There'll be some constant divided by k plus j to the s, where j is one of the numbers appearing on the bottom, and s is, let's say, 1 less than or equal to s less than or equal to d. And, of course, we're summing these over k. And what is that? It's just a times the value zeta of s minus the initial segment, k equals 1 up to j, 1 over k to the s. So, since the coefficient here will be rational, we do get a rational multiple of zeta of s minus a rational number. So, sure enough, any series of this kind will give us a linear form in the values of zeta 2, 3, 4 up to d. So we get a form in, well, there'll be a constant term, if you like, a rational term, and then we get all the zeta values up to zeta of d, possibly. Now, for the forms that we cook up, there are really two things that we have to do to move beyond the forms for zeta of 2. And the first is to understand why these forms are small. Remember, we want the linear forms to be small in size, so we need to understand why they're small. So the forms are small because of the zeros in the numerator. These are the forms that came from Boyka's integrals, or Apéry's forms, but this expression. And the point is that because of these zeros, the sum doesn't really start at 1, it starts at m plus 1. And by the time k is m plus 1, the denominator is nice and large, and so the sum will be small. So the sum doesn't start until k is m plus 1, by which time, or at which point the denominator is nice and big. So this sort of helps to explain the form of those forms, or the form of those series. Now, in our case, in order to get this log d factor, we need a little bit more smallness than you can get just in this way. And the extra smallness that we need comes from putting in extra zeros. So we want something like k minus 1, k minus 2, down to something bigger than m. And, of course, we've got room to put in extra zeros because we now have a higher power on the bottom. So we won't stop the series converging by putting in extra zeros as long as this r is not too big compared to d. And it's convenient, as you can guess from the way I've written it, to take this r to be a natural number. In other words, to take the number of zeros to be an integral multiple of m, the m being determined by the last factor here. So it's convenient to take R a natural number. And we have room to do that, of course. Okay, what next? So we've found a way of cooking up forms which, with a bit of luck, will be nice and small, which are indeed linear forms with rational coefficients in the values of zeta up to zeta of d. And, of course, the problem is, if we include the even number values, then we're out of luck, because if we try and cross-cancel half the values, we have no chance. We know we can only cross-cancel log d of the values. So it's no good just working with a form that looks like this. We've got to find some way to get rid of all the even number values at once. Such a form will tell you that infinitely many of the values of zeta at the integers are irrational, but since it's already known for all the even ones, this is not a not a very useful fact. Okay, so to eliminate the even number values, it's pretty clear that we need to do it somehow all in one go. And if you know that you can do it all in one go, you can guess how it's done. You use some parity argument. So we use a parity argument. So I'm going to choose this polynomial P according to some parity rule, and that parity rule will depend upon the particular D and M in question. So for the sake of simplicity, let's fix that D is odd, which I've sort of been assuming anyway, but let's also fix that M is even, so that we know where we stand on issues of parity. Okay, so we have this function f of k, this summand, which will be p of k over k plus 1, k plus m to the d. And we choose the polynomial p to be an even function, an even polynomial, as a function of k plus m over 2. So I will choose p to be an even function in k plus m over 2. In other words, if I were to shift to minus m over 2, it would be an even function, or equivalently, p of minus k minus m is the same as p of k. Now, what does that tell us about f? Because of the way this parity interacts with the parities of d and m, this tells us that f at minus k minus m is what? Well, obviously, it's like f of k, and when we change k to minus k minus m, the top doesn't change because p is even. What happens here, k goes to minus k minus m, which is like that, but with a minus sign, and everything, in fact, inverts, but with minus signs. So we get the same thing on the bottom, except that the number of minus signs is the number of factors on the bottom, which is minus 1 to the m plus 1, times d. Okay? So if m plus 1 factors on the bottom inside the exponent d, and then with the parity that I've got, this is minus f of k. So f is an odd function about minus m over 2. Right, why is that a good thing? Yeah, so I can leave that there, I think. So let's consider terms in the partial fraction expansion from opposite ends. In other words, I match k with k plus m, k plus 1 with k plus m minus 1, and so on. So I compare two terms, for example, a over k and whatever power I'm considering at the time, and b over k plus m to the s. And then I watch what happens as I make this switch from k to minus k minus m. So what happens here is that, and what happens here is that. And I know, because my function changes sign when I make this switch, that the term I end up with here should be minus this term that I had before. This is the only way that I can pair off the expressions in the partial fraction expansion. And so I know that these have to be opposite, have to add up to zero. And then depending upon whether S is even or odd, that will tell us something different about the coefficients A and B. If if S is even, which is the case we care about, if S is even, then the minus sign here has no effect, and so what we need is that A and B are opposites. And that means that when you look at the contributions they give, these two terms give, to the coefficient of zeta of S, remember each of these was one of the things that produced some zeta of S for us, those two terms will cancel out, those two coefficients will cancel out. Of course, the same thing happens for any other pair of opposite poles, and so we'll get a total contribution of zero to the coefficient of zeta of S. So, their contributions to the coefficient of zeta of S cancel. And this, by the same argument for all the other pairs of opposite poles, will tell us that zeta of S doesn't appear in the form. Does not appear. And this, of course, if S is even. If S is odd, then the coefficients reinforce one another, but we don't really care that about that. But clearly, in order to get something interesting, we would have to have a situation in which we didn't get cancellation of all the coefficients, but that's automatic. Right. Okay, that means I can now tell you what our forms really are. So we've got sigma k equals 1 to infinity. We've got the product of factors on top that give us a nice lot of zeros. We've got the thing you already know on the bottom. And then in order to achieve the parity that we require for the polynomial on the top, we have to put in balancing zeros to these, and we do it like this. I'll write it like that. So for each one, from 1 up to Rm, we have a zero which balances the zero we actually want in order to get the parity right. That's almost it, but we have to put in a factor which is like the factor that I put in the front of the forms for zeta of 2, for arithmetic reasons, and we'll see in a second what that factor does for us. Of course, the point is at some point we've got to get integer coefficients rather than rationals, so clearly the factor has to come into play here in some way. Right, now, there's a point which I glossed over in referring to these as forms with integer coefficients. So let me explain what that was. If you actually write down the form that you get here, so suppose I just say this is equal to am0 plus am3 zeta of 3, etc., am d minus 2 zeta of d minus 2, am d zeta of d, then with the arithmetic, with the extra factor in front, the arithmetic issues don't work out quite right. We don't quite get integers as the coefficients. The coefficient of zeta of d will indeed be an integer. But as you go back, that will no longer be true. And the previous one, for example, in order to make it an integer, we'll have to multiply by a factor L squared, where L is the least common multiple of the numbers 1 up to m. And then the pattern continues, so we need L to the 4th for the previous one, and then right at the start, we need L to the d to put that into the integers. And so, having constructed the forms in this way, we're going to have to clear this factor of L to the D. And naturally, we hope that this isn't going to blow the size estimates for the coefficients, or for that matter, the forms themselves. So we have to clear L to the D. And Fortunately, although you may be thinking this is going to cause serious problems, this number isn't anything like n factorial. The prime number theorem tells us that it's significantly smaller than n factorial. It implies actually that L is roughly e to the m, and then when we clear L to the d, we precisely are happy about the sizes. This causes no problems for the size of the coefficients or of the forms. Okay, so we need to use... Well, we don't need the full prime number theorem. We need just some weak version, of which many were proved long before the prime number theorem itself. We don't need e to the m. We could have any constant here, and with a fairly large constant, this is much easier to prove. Okay, I suppose, let's see, yes, I've got plenty of time. I can say a word about the proofs of the various assertions that that we need, the sizes and so on, these arithmetic issues. Let's see, why don't I start with the arithmetic issue. So proofs, this will just be an outline. And let's start with this divisibility or arithmetic issue. Now, statements of this kind were well known in a variety of contexts of this type. In particular, for Apéry's original forms, there was a similar issue that arose. So they were more or less folklore, but what we need appeared essentially explicitly in the paper of Nikishin that I already alluded to. The simplest way to demonstrate this is to show that the same properties, so these properties here that are written precisely over there, the same properties hold for any series in which we use a summand of the following kind. So we take a product of d different factors, each of which will just have k plus j on the bottom rather than k plus j to the d, and I'm allowed to sum j equals naught up to m. So this will give me something of the form I want, and I'm allowed to put coefficients here which are integers. So any summand that I build in this way by taking a product of sums of integers over k plus j will have this property. And once you know that that's what you're aiming for, it's not very difficult to check. You just look at the product and look at the Lorentz series around each of the poles and check that the coefficients have the properties you want. And the fact that our particular forms look like this is simple combinatorics. Of course, as you know, for example, if you sum binomial coefficients, sorry, this should be j here, k plus j, 0 up to m, then you get something like m factorial over k plus 1, k plus m, possibly with a minus sign to some power. I can't... let's see, if I start with k is 0, yeah, it should be positive. Okay. And similar things work even when you have stuff on the top as well, so this is fairly simple combinatorics.
K is the parameter?
Yeah, k is the parameter over which we sum to infinity in the end, yes. Did I mix it up with j anywhere? I did it at one point, but not anymore, yeah. Okay, what about the sizes of the coefficients? So this is the usual argument in this sort of setup. You've got some partial fractions. You want to find the size of the coefficients. You use the residue theorem. So we have this function f of z, and I'll write it now as z minus 1 dot, 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 down to all the way up to z plus rm plus m, and I'll divide here by m factorial to the 2r, and then on the bottom I have z plus 1 up to z plus m over m factorial to the d. So I put the m factorials in the right places, as it were. And then when I want to estimate the size of the coefficients in the partial fraction, so I use the residue theorem. So I have to integrate things like f of z plus j to the s minus 1. That will tell me the contribution of the pole at minus j to the coefficient of 1 over... to the coefficient of zeta of s. Let's put it that way. That's the easiest way to say it. And, of course, I have to integrate it around the pole. At minus j. And there's nothing too problematical here. So we have poles at minus m plus 1, all the way up to 0. And we can integrate around circles of radius 1/2. We don't have to play any games with the radius of the circle. We just take the simplest things and estimate quite crudely. What happens is the denominator really plays no role in how big these things are. All that matters is how many things you've got in the numerator. And the estimate you pick up at the end will be that each coefficient will be controlled by something like constant to the MD times, let's be generous, d to the mr. And the r in the exponent comes from the number of terms on the top. That's the real issue. And so we're okay here. Okay, if r is no more than d over log d. So to get the sizes under control, we have to stop somewhat before r has got up to d. We have to divide by at least log d. Okay. Now, what about the sizes of the forms? I've already told you, in a sense, how we estimate those. So what have we got here? M factorial to the d minus 2r, sigma k, k minus 1, k minus rm, k plus m plus 1, k plus m plus rm, over k, k plus 1, k plus m to the d. And the crucial point is that I'm really only summing over k bigger than rm. And we can estimate this by the same thing but with a maximum instead of a sum, as long as we drop, let's say, the k to the d on the bottom, which sums out. So same thing, but let's only go from k plus 1 up to k plus m, and then the same thing on top. And we can estimate this fantastically crudely. I'm glad that all the combinatoricists have left, because they would be wincing at the horrors I'm about to perpetrate. Wincing. I'll explain afterwards. Okay, so what am I going to do? I'm going to replace m factorial by m to the m. I'm going to replace this product by k to the rm. I'm going to be really nasty here. K is bigger than rm, so this rm here is no more than k, so I can replace this by 3k to the rm. And on the bottom, everything's at least, I've now only got from k plus 1 onwards, but it's certainly at least k to the md. Okay? I know, it's horrible, isn't it? So what have we got here? This is 3 to the r, m over k, to the d minus 2r, to the m. Did I leave out anything else? No, that's okay. I should have put the max k bigger than rm here. And now, since K is bigger than Rm, this is at most R. So I've got 3 to the R over R to the D minus 2R to the M. Problem?
How is it you're estimating the sum by a maximum?
Oh, just because sigma K to the D is at most 1, so I just leave it out, yeah, and then we're happy. Yeah. But, of course, the point is that, actually, in the spirit of this conference, the terms here are very concentrated around the average, right? So, so this is not where the problem occurs, actually. The problem occurs, well, not there's no problem, but it's not where the crudity occurs. The crudity occurs over there.
It's not in the spirit of the conference.
No, I agree. This is not in the spirit of the conference. Okay, oh, I shouldn't really have erased that, should I? Okay, what was written down there was R at most D over log D, because I had an estimate over here of the form D to the R. And the point, of course, is that now, for the sizes of the forms, I have an estimate R to the D. And so I can get away with, so for the forms... For the forms, we have 1 over R to the D, so we need only take R to be bigger than, say, a power of D or something. We have lots of room. Right. And the last thing, the last thing I should say something about is the non-zeroness of the determinants. So this was the stronger statement than merely that the forms are non-zero. Of course, these are obviously non-zero, but we need much more than that. We need that we can build these non-zero determinants. Now, this isn't too difficult to do directly, as long as we cook up forms specifically for the purpose. So this is fairly easy if we do just a little bit more cooking. So what do I mean? Instead of looking at this function fk, which is all the stuff on the top over all the stuff on the bottom, with this factor, instead of choosing successive ones as we increase m, which is bad news because when you increase m, pretty much everything changes. And so it's rather hard to control how that's happening. Instead of that, we fix an m here, and then we look at all the possible forms we can get by putting in an extra even polynomial in k plus m over 2, and we take however many we need. We need d, roughly. And we show that when you look at these things, the coefficients are linearly independent. That means that when you collapse down to j columns, you can find j rows which remain linearly independent, or j plus 1 rows which remain linearly independent, and then get a non-zero determinant. So as long as you cook up your forms so that only a little bit is changing as you move from form to form, it's rather simple polynomial algebra to check that you can get linear independence. However, we don't actually have to do that. There is a nice criterion which we can simply invoke. Due to Nestorenko. So I'll write Nestorenko's criterion. And this guarantees that in the kind of situation we've got, we will always be able to find linear forms with a non-zero determinant, provided that we have more information. So we're always okay if we have a little more information about these forms. So remember, the forms are indexed by M. And if instead of just having size control over the forms, we actually have an asymptotic formula, that this converges to some positive number, which of course depends on D and R as m goes to infinity, then Nesterenko's criterion will guarantee that you have the right number of irrational values or the right dimension of the space over the rationals. And the point here, of course, is that...
For any such forms?
If you have a sequence of forms in some variables, and you know that they have integer coefficients, and you have an asymptotic formula like this, and, of course, you'd have the size and estimates for the coefficients and the forms themselves. I mean, obviously, if this is huge, they're useless. Then you're guaranteed the right number of irrational things. Okay. And the point, of course, is that this is an analytic condition which is going to yield an algebraic criterion, algebraic conclusion, namely that the determinants are non-zero. So clearly, this has to be a kind of strong analytic non-zeroness in addition to the size estimates for the coefficients. So it's natural that you need something considerably stronger than just saying they're not big. You need that they're also nothing like zero. Naturally, Nesterenko's criterion is harder than to do this in any particular case, but I mean, that criterion was proved to be used. I mean, it was meant to be used, so there it is, to be used. Okay, I think that's everything. One further comment. In the last year or so, since this was done, there have been sharper estimates proved by my collaborator, Rivewell, and also by Russian mathematician Zudilin in particular, probably others as well, but these are the two I know about. And I think Zudilin can... So the estimates they get still give you log d among the first d, but with a better constant. And in particular, that means that for particular numbers of d, you can find an irrational value sooner. And I think Zudilin has one of zeta of 5, zeta of 7, zeta of 9, possibly he needs zeta of 11, I can't quite remember, is irrational. So, in other words, by improving the constant, you can decrease the distance you have to go before you hit before you're guaranteed to hit an irrational. But they all use the same parity construction. It's different series, which are better equipped to give you size estimates of different kinds.
Type of cooking, you may take out other arithmetic progression, not only integer.
Nope. Or you mean not only even ones?
Not only even ones.
I very much doubt it. I think that.
The
point is that although you get to choose the denominator, the numerator, but you don't get to choose the denominator. That's the problem. So you're stuck with the symmetries of the denominator.
So zeta of 5 is zeta of 9.
That's right. Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, tomorrow at 9:30, the next lecture.